This is Macro Voices, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Macro Voices episode 391 was produced on August 31st, 2023. I'm Eric Townsend. Brent Johnson returns as this week's feature interview guest. We'll discuss the reasons Brent thinks the U.S. dollar bull market is not over yet and why Brent thinks new highs for the dollar index are still to come.
And I'm Patrick Ceresna with the Macro Scoreboard week over week as of the close of Wednesday, August 30th, 2023. The S&P 500 S&P futures were up 235 basis points to 45.24. We'll take a closer look at that chart and the key technical levels to watch in our post-game segment. The U.S. dollar index down 26 basis points, closing at 103.20. The dollar finding resistance at previous 2023 highs. That October WTI crude oil contract up 283 points to 81.63. The big question, is the correction over? We'll take a look at that chart in post-game, and Eric will have that EIA inventory data. The December gold contract up 233 basis points to 1973. It's bouncing off its oversold levels. Copper up 492 basis points to 384, retracing the weakness earlier in August. And uranium up 402 basis points to 59.45, trading at new highs for 2023, with the 2022 highs at $64 being the next target. U.S. 10-year Treasury yield down 13 basis points to 412 points, pulling back from retesting those October 2022 highs. The key news to watch is Friday's jobs numbers, and next week we have the Bank of Canada rate statement. This week's feature interview guest is Brent Johnson. Eric, why did we invite Brent back on the show this week?
Well, Patrick, I feel it's time to take a much closer look at the U.S. dollar. I don't pretend to know all the answers, but I do assert that I'm better than some at knowing what to focus on. I say the dollar is the thing to focus on. Two of the guests that we've had on Macro Voices in past years with outspoken views on the U.S. dollar have been Brent Johnson and Luke Groman. So we've got Brent this week, and we've already booked Luke in coming weeks in order to get his perspective as well.
Well, Eric's interview with Brent Johnson is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's your host, Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is Santiago Capital founder Brent Johnson. Brent, it's been, boy, a long time. Great to get you back on the show.
Yeah, happy to be here, Eric. I'm always happy to talk to you and your listeners.
Folks, Brent has prepared a slide deck to accompany this week's interview, and you're really going to enjoy this one because Brent's done something for us that very few guests are willing to do, which is he took his slide deck from when he was on Macro Voices a year ago, reproduced it, updated it, and is prepared to talk about what he got right and what he got wrong. But before we even get into that, Brent, I want to frame this discussion in the sense that we have a very, very different geopolitical situation than we had a year ago the last time we spoke. The situation between Ukraine and Russia, lots of people have lots of opinions. My opinion is very much that this is likely to escalate beyond just Russia and Ukraine. I think that the tension through the Ukraine crisis between the United States and Russia is likely to escalate to United States, Russia, and China, all being in a new challenge of who really is the global hegemonic superpower, both militarily and economically, over the world. First question, Brent, is do you agree whether or not we're actually at risk? I'm not necessarily making an opinion on, but do you agree that the United States' position in the world is at least going to be challenged by Russia and China? And if so, I think we ought to focus this conversation on, okay, what does that mean for your prognosis for the dollar?
Sure. And I would totally agree with you on that. You know, I've kind of categorized what's going on as the big game or the great game or even a Game of Thrones. because I really think that that is what's happening now. And it doesn't mean it's all going to necessarily happen tomorrow or next week, but that is where the ball is headed. And I, unfortunately, as much as I would love to see this turn around and go back the other way, I just don't think that that's likely. So I think we need to prepare for more volatility and more hostility than we've seen so far.
Before we dive into markets and what's changed since last year, give me your perspective on this BRICS Bucks initiative. Essentially, the Global South, the countries in the BRICS Alliance are trying to say, look, we're sick of U.S. dollar hegemony over the global financial system. We're going to create our own reserve currency of sorts that's defined by and administered by the BRICS countries, independent of the U.S. dollar. Most of the U.S. financial community, the Western financial community, is basically ignoring this completely. Writing it off is just rhetoric that's completely safe to ignore. Do you agree with that, or how do you see this?
Well, I don't think you can ignore it. You know, if you look at the BRICS, you look at the population that falls under the BRICS, you look at the global GDP that falls under the BRICS, you look at what the economies in the BRICS countries have, namely commodities. It's too big of a block to just totally ignore and write off. And I would not suggest that anybody do that. However, I think where my view starts to differ from perhaps some others is that I also don't believe that just because these five or six or eight or nine countries, however you want to define that, just because they say they're going to do something, I've seen little actual progress in doing it. And even if they were to try to do it more fully than they already are, I am skeptical of their ability to actually implement it and pull it off. And then finally, bringing it back to what you kind of set this whole conversation up as, I think if they were to do those things, if they were to start to implement it, and if they were to start to see some success in it, I don't think that the U.S. would just sit back and watch it happen. I would expect the U.S. to reply in perhaps some unwelcomed manner, is maybe the polite way to say it.
Well, let's take the risk of going into the impolite, because I think it needs to be discussed. What kind of sanction or remedy do you think the U.S. would invoke? I agree with you. The U.S. would not want to tolerate the actual introduction of a BRICS currency system that poses a real and meaningful threat to the dollar and its position in the world. So it sounds like we agree on that. If we got to the point where there really was something starting to look like a threat, what do you think the U.S. would do about it?
Well, I think the first thing that they would do is put incredible amount of diplomatic pressure on the countries on the margin that they thought that they could influence. Now, whether that's helping them out with some internal problems that they're having, whether it's giving them more in foreign aid, or whether it's, you know, voting with them on some issue at the United Nations, that would be the first thing I would expect them to do. The second thing I would expect them to do is to employ some more sanctions and economic sanctions. And I know that there's going to be a number of people that will immediately say, well, sanctions don't work. They backfire. And that is fair. And I will not deny that sanctions often end up boomeranging back and causing problems at home. But I think if you were to take a look at the economies of Russia, Iran, Venezuela, and some of the other North Korea, some of the other countries that have been, you know, under sanctions regimes over the last 5, 10 years, however you want to define that, you know, it's very hard for them to operate. It's not impossible. And of course, there's workarounds and there's black markets, but they're not as efficient as, you know, working through the traditional channels. And so, you know, I think while, but all of this, I think, would just lead to more volatility in the markets. I don't think that the BRICS could do something that would hurt the U.S. without causing volatility. And I don't think that the U.S. could respond to the BRICS in some way to hurt them without causing volatility. So I think regardless of which way we go here, Eric, unless everybody just gets together and starts singing Kumbaya, again, I think we're headed for more volatility rather than less.
Now, if we accept the possibility that this challenge is going to occur and that the BRICS will attempt to threaten the U.S. dollar's hegemony, a lot of people would say, okay, well, if that happens, it could mean the U.S. dollar is at risk of crashing. I think you and I have generally had kind of an opposite view from that, which is, well, wait a minute, if the U.S. dollar were to lose that battle, it might end up crashing. But long before that could ever happen, if the U.S. dollar were being challenged, it's probably more likely to appreciate substantially against other currencies because of the challenge. Is that still your view? And if so, please elaborate on why you see it that way, because it is opposite what some people might think is the intuitive response. You know, if the dollar is being challenged, that means the dollar could go down.
Yeah. And here's the thing is, it's a really, really important issue to understand here. And the reality is I'm extremely sympathetic to the idea that the dollar is going to lose value, because I think it eventually is going to. But what I think the key to it is and this is completely understandable why many people miss this, is because most people, even who have worked in finance for decades, literally don't understand it. And that is the euro dollar market. And the, you know, we've talked about this several times, Eric, and I know you're familiar with it, but perhaps some of your readers are not, or your listeners are not, and that there is a market outside the United States that is denominated in dollars. And this is, you know, China trading with the Philippines, or Japan trading with Thailand, or Turkey trading with France. And oftentimes loans, invoices, you know, just straight up trade deals take place in dollars. And so there's a huge amount of US dollar debt that is owed by entities outside the United States. And it's over $30 trillion. And the BIS even says with off balance sheet, it's closer to $80 trillion. Now, everybody knows that the United States owes $30 trillion, but I don't think as many people realize that the rest of the world owes over $30 trillion in U.S. dollars. And the key is that they don't owe it to the United States. They owe it to themselves. So again, it's Turkey owing it to France, or it's, you know, India owing it to South Africa, or whatever it is. I'm kind of making up names here. But the point with this is that to de-dollarize, they would also have to deleverage all that US dollar debt. So de-dollarization is the equivalent of deleveraging. And typically when something deleverages, the underlying price of the currency that is being deleveraged rises versus the goods and services. That is what a credit contraction and a deleveraging event typically provides. Now, I suppose there's some secret formula out there that somebody could invent that could allow them to somehow escape this, but I have yet to understand it. And so I think that the point would be is if the rest of the world were to default on all this US dollar debt, it would also mean that the rest of the world is losing $30 trillion in assets, because one in a debt-based system, one person's liability is another person's asset. So the rest of the world would have to all agree at the same time what would be replacing that US dollar credit. And then they would have to all implement it at the same time. And then somebody would have to enforce it and operate it. And I just think that's really, really hard to do, because again, I don't think the US would sit back and just let it happen. The other thing I would say is that I agree that the many parts of the rest of the world want to de-dollarize. But I would also say a big part of it, the people that want to de-dollarize are the politicians, are the monetary authorities. You know, I have yet to see, you know, a large number of foreign business leaders saying, wow, I would really like to stop doing business in US dollars. I have yet to see, you know, someone from the BRICS countries stand side by side with the presidents and say, yeah, this is horrible. We hate the dollar. Because I think that in many ways, they like the dollar. The dollar helps them protect against their own home currencies, which are often much, much worse than the US dollar. So I understand the need or the desire to de-dollarize. Nobody wants to be subservient to someone else. Every country wants to be their own sovereign. But I think the actual ability to actually pull it off under extremely difficult circumstances would be much more difficult than perhaps, you know, those who believe in the BRICS do.
Let's dive into your slide deck starting on page 2. When we talked to you last year, the dollar index was around 109. You told us then that it still had room to go higher, and absolutely, it did go higher. What happened? What was the cause of it? Kind of looks like a blow-off top there, and what's caused the trading action we see on this chart since then?
Well, I think your description of that is very good, a blow-off top. I mean, you can see that, you know, from the end of August when I was talking to you last until, you know, the end of September, it rose from 109, another 5%, kind of up to the 114, almost 115 range. And a lot of that took place literally in the last, call it 10 days or 12 days of September. So it was a pretty fast move. And I think a lot of it was that, you know, the U.S. had been hiking rates very aggressively through October. And, you know, everybody kind of started to get off sides. And if you remember back to the end of September of last year, equities were at the lowest point in 2 years. The VIX was at its highest point in 2 years. The euro was at its low point. the yen was at its low point. The yuan was having trouble, or China was having trouble with the real estate market over there. And the Bank of England, the pound was at its low. And the Bank of England had to bail out the gilts market. The ECB was buying Italian bonds. And the Bank of Japan was not only supporting the yen market, but also the JGB market. So we literally had a confluence of events. And it was all the, if you actually go to the next slide, you know, the last week of literally the morning of the high, I sent out a tweet and I just basically said, this isn't over. The dollar still has a lot further to run in the long term. But in the short term, now everybody seems to be on board and it's probably due for a pullback. And sure enough, that was the high. And part of so what has led to the drawdown over the next year, let's call it, or we're at 11 months now, right? 10 or 11 months, is it was largely due to rate hike expectations. As the Fed was aggressively hiking rates and the market was expecting them to continue doing so, the market just rocketed higher. But then with the foreign central banks coming in at the end of September, intervening in their markets to support their currencies, and at the same time, the data in the U.S. started to kind of roll over. The inflationary data started to roll over. And then we got into October and November, and the data continued to weaken. And therefore, the rate hike expectations started to fall. That's when the dollar started to roll over, and that kind of blow off top kind of gave back its gains really quickly. Now, I thought it would pull back to about the 105 level. You know, 105 to 108 level. I did not expect it to pull back and I thought it would maybe pull back for 6 months. So it actually pulled all the way back to, I think, 98 or 99 about a month ago. And it's been almost a year. So it's pulled back a little farther than I expected and a little longer than I expected. But now we're kind of back to where we are. You know, we're about 104 level now. So, you know, over the last year, the dollar's down, let's call it 4 or 5%. And you know, but what I also show is what many people forget is if we go back to the beginning of the century, the year 2000, the dollar was lower than it is now. And think of everything that's happened over the last 20 years, especially over the last 15 years, as far as QE, bailouts, helicopter money, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so the reason I bring this up is because a lot of people will use QE, bailouts, helicopter as evidence to me that the U.S. is going to have to do this, and therefore the dollar is going to fall. And I keep pointing out to them, yes, they will probably do those, but so will all the other countries. And as a result, since currencies trade relative to each other, it hasn't really hurt the dollar that much. And in fact, you could argue since, you know, QE and all these extraordinary monetary measures have started, you know, the DXY, the dollar's up 15 or 20% versus its peers. I would expect that to continue in the years ahead.
Brent, I want to go back to page 2 and the circle on the right edge of the chart, because if I mentally adjust this red downsloping line just down a little bit so it touches those tops on the market back in February and May, June timeframe, boy, it looks like there's the beginning of a breakout above that trend line, but only just barely. Are you saying this is the beginning of a breakout, or are you watching it? Where do you stand in terms of whether or not the trend is beginning to change already?
Well, I think if you look at the last month, the trend has already changed. You know, the dollar had a very hard pullback. Again, went from 114 to 99, you know, in basically a nine-month period. That's a pretty big move for a currency. And you know, what we had in July was basically the opposite of what we had last September. And so I think we've kind of established a bottom there, you know, in July. The dollar has had a really good bounce over the last 6 weeks, and a number of the foreign currencies, which I'm sure we'll talk about at some point, are extremely weak. And then we're kind of at the point where those central banks need to consider, you know, intervening again. So I'm actually, in the very, very short term, it wouldn't surprise me at all if the dollar kind of hangs around this level or maybe even pulls back. But, you know, I have not changed my view at all as far as, you know, where we're headed kind of in the medium to long term. And I think that not only will we break above this kind of downsloping line that you're highlighting, but I think we will go back to that 114 level and even through that.
And what are the primary drivers that are going to take us back to that 114 level and through it? And also, when we got there before, a whole lot of people were saying, hey, wait a minute, if this goes any farther, because of the impacts it's going to have, because of the borrowing dynamics that you described, it's going to cause a whole bunch of people around the world to go broke. We can't let this happen. It's going to cause a crisis. Are you saying that crisis is coming? And if so, what's the driver that's going to take us there?
Well, I think there's several crises that could take us there. One of them we've already talked about, and that is the geopolitical uncertainties. You know, I don't think you have to take too big of a leap to imagine that the war in Ukraine could spill over into some neighboring countries, and then it becomes a NATO issue. I don't think it's too big of a leap to think that, you know, China will continue to demand that Taiwan show allegiance to them, and that has the potential to lead to geopolitical problems. So that's the first thing to come to mind, and I would imagine that in that type of a scenario, both dollars and gold would probably do extremely well. The other thing that I think could lead to it is I still think that Powell is going to hike in September. And I think the only reason he doesn't hike is if we have a big, severe market dislocation prior to September. So I think rate hikes are still going to go higher. The other thing is you always have to remember that everything is relative. I don't think that what's going on in the European economy is as good as what's going on in the U.S. economy. So I don't think that the ECB is going to be able to continue with their forecasted rate hikes to the same level they would be able to. And so that's what you got to remember. A lot of the reason that the dollar has fallen over the last year is the expectation that there would be no further rate hikes in the US and there would still be rate hikes in Europe and Japan and Asia and other places. So I think if those kind of expectations got reset a little bit and the US were to stay higher for longer, and the rest of the world were not to hike as aggressively, that could give the dollar a bid. The other thing is, and we'll get to this in a little bit, I think what's going on in Japan is really, really important. And in many ways, I think the yen is the key to everything. But what the yen is doing right now is that it weakens, it puts an incredible amount of pressure on China, which is a regional trading, not only a regional trading partner, but a regional trading competitor. And as Japanese goods get cheaper in yen terms, it puts pressure, it makes it easier for foreigners to buy Japanese goods than choose Chinese goods. And China's already dealing with some severe deflationary pressures in their real estate market. I think we're getting to the point where China is going to have to seriously consider either bailing out their entire real estate market or do some other kind of program to help that. And that would lead to the yuan weakening, I believe. And if there was to be some kind of a surprise deval of the yuan or even just more weakness in the yuan, that probably gives a tailwind to the dollar. And so I those are three reasons right off the top of my head where I think the dollar could still surprise to the upside.
Brent, let's go to page 10 and the euro chart. First of all, this is a long-term chart, so the breakdown that you're showing below a long-term trend line is not just something that's, you know, happened this month or this week. You're looking at over the last several years, you're charting a breakdown below a significant trend line. Am I reading that correctly? And what are you expecting as we approach this retest here?
Yeah, and this kind of goes back to what I was just talking about a few minutes ago with regard to the European economy. Now, the euro had a very big slide last year. And again, you know, almost 11 months ago, you know, the ECB was getting to the point where they were having to buy, you know, Italian BTPs because they were kind of blowing out versus German bunds. And so and the euro was at its lowest level in, you know, close to 20 years. Now, when the dollar started to roll over, it got a bounce and it's had a very good bounce. But now it is, when it broke that long-term trend line, you know, let's call it at the beginning of 22, that was a severe break. And it fell all the way and it went below par for, you know, a couple of weeks. And now it's bounced all the way back up. And now it's retesting that previous support line, which is now resistance. So I think it's a pretty interesting level that we're at right now. And, you know, if it breaks through, then sure, it can go higher. But I think the odds are that it's going to kind of keep testing that level, but it's eventually going to break back down, mainly because I don't think the European economy is in as good a shape as the U.S. economy. And I don't think that the European economy can deal with, even if the ECB does continue to hike rates, I don't think that their economy is strong enough to withstand it. You know, one thing we haven't really talked about is part of the reason that earlier this year we had a banking issue in the United States, and it was related to the U.S. aggressively hiking rates and our banks were holding, you know, low yielding treasuries. You got to remember these European banks are holding negative yielding European sovereigns. So as rates go higher in Europe, those bonds are under increasing pressure and those banks' balance sheets are getting upturned to the same level that the U.S. bank balance sheets were getting upturned. So they have a number of challenges to deal with higher rates. And so if those rates don't go higher and the economy continues to slow, and perhaps they even go back to some further forms of QE themselves, I think that would be a reason that the euro bumps its head against this now resistance level and trades back down below par.
It seems to me that there is absolutely no reason for Russia to try and weaponize energy prices in the summertime. Guess what? It's not quite fall yet, but we're getting there quickly. Does it make sense to think about risk to both the euro currency and the European economy as we come into winter? In terms of energy prices, it seems to me like this is where the vulnerability period comes. Have you considered that, and what are your thoughts?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm glad you brought that up, because that's actually an extremely big one. So again, there's a number of different places that these shocks can come from. Again, I don't know if and when they're going to develop. I just know that the table is set for kind of these totally global shocks. And one of the biggest ones is out of Europe, and it has to do with the energy markets and the fact that, Russia, the Ukraine war continues to drag on. Now, last year, in many ways, I would argue not just Europe, but the world as a whole got very lucky that it was a very mild winter. And not only that, but the U.S. was able to replace a large number of the gas supplies into Europe with LNG from the United States. I don't know that we're going to get that lucky again this year. I think it would be very unlikely that we got that lucky with that low or with that warm of a winter. And so as we get closer into here, I would not be surprised at all if Putin were to, try to do some additional measures that would hurt Europe more than it hurt last year. And so that can easily happen. And you have to remember, this is part of the reason the euro was falling last year, is because they were having to do all these stimulus measures and QE measures to a certain extent in order to fight against not just the war in Ukraine, but the war on energy prices. Now, initially, energy prices really skyrocketed. By late spring, early summer, it wasn't nearly as bad. But for a while there, it was touch and go. And as those currencies fell, as the euro fell and oil rose, energy prices were rising in the United States when the dollar was rising. Imagine being in Europe, where not only is oil and natural gas prices rising, but your currency is down 10 or 15%. It's like a double whammy. And so I think that could easily happen again.
Brent, when I look at slide 11 in your chart of the yen, it's interesting unto itself, but frankly, what I find more interesting is the comparison to the chart we just looked at on page 10. Because if I go back to page 10, as you just described, okay, look, we saw a breakdown on the euro. It hit what clearly was a short-term bottom. Looks like maybe it's retesting that previous support line as resistance, but it's early to make that call. I wouldn't make that call yet. Could still go above it. But boy, if I look at page 11, what we saw here was the yen broke down harder than the euro did. It tried to recover. It didn't even make it back up to the previous support line, which would be resistance, but we didn't get anywhere close to it. And it looks like it's really dropping again. Is it reasonable for me to extrapolate that this chart is telling me that it's probably more likely to see a downward outcome to slide 10 than that slide by itself might reveal?
Yeah, so Eric, I think this chart is probably the most important chart for me in the entire slide deck, because I think in many ways the yen is key to it all. Now, similar to the euro, it had a huge breakdown last year and broke like a 40-year, support line. I'm using the yen futures contract here, and as it falls, that is the yen losing value. It fell down really hard, it bounced, and now has rolled over again. And part of the reason is because the Bank of Japan is now at a place where it has to choose of whether to save the bond market or save the currency market. The problem with trying to save both is that one program that would help the currency would hurt the bonds. And if you try to help the bonds, then you hurt the currency. And so, the reason that they're in such a tight spot is that Japan has been issuing negative yielding JGBs for a number of years. And so all of the banks, the insurance companies, the endowments, the pension funds are loaded to the gills with negative yielding Japanese government bonds. If interest rates were to rise, which they have been pressured to do due to Japan finally getting some inflationary pressures, then all the bonds on all those balance sheets, start to fall in value, and the whole balance sheets for the whole system start to get turned over. And it can very quickly lead to an entire banking system crisis over there. And so, but the problem is the yen just keeps losing so much value that, you know, the Bank of Japan has a hard time just letting it keep going down. So they've a couple times come out and said, we are going to widen the band that we do yield curve control. So yield curve control is the program via which they control interest rates in Japan so the government bond prices don't fall. But they've said, we're going to widen that band a little bit to allow for some inflationary pressures. But when they do that, every time they've done that, then the Japanese government bonds fall and things start to go wacky really quick. And they've had to every time come back in and start immediately buying a bunch of JGBs. And as a result, the currency has just rolled back over. Now, in the very short term, you know, as I alluded to with the dollar and even the euro, it's gotten really weak here. And it wouldn't surprise me at all to see a short-term bounce. But ultimately, at the end of the day, I believe that Japan will choose to sacrifice their currency and save their bond market. Because if they choose the other way around, if they choose to save their currency, then they risk a banking system collapse. And I just don't see that happening. So I actually expect the yen to go much lower. And this, again, as I alluded to earlier, this puts pressure on China. And it becomes a huge problem. Now, here's the interesting thing, Eric. Let's say I'm wrong. If I am wrong and Japan chooses to forego yield curve control, allows interest rates to rise, and allows the yen to appreciate, then what's going to happen, in my opinion, maybe not initially, because at this level, the yen rallying a little bit would probably be risk on for the rest of the world, because it would relieve a little bit of dollar pressure. But if it goes very high very quickly, then Japanese yen carry traders are going to start flooding back into Japan. What I mean by that is, this is important to understand. For years, because Japanese government interest rates have been extremely low or even negative, yen carry traders, which means people will borrow in yen because it doesn't cost them anything to do it, and then they'll take that money and they'll go invest it abroad in either foreign government bonds or equities or real estate. And then as you know, those projects produce a return, they pay off the yen that isn't costing them anything. So if they can even find a project that yields them 1-3% and they lever it up a couple times, now all of a sudden they're earning 6%. That works as long as the yen is not costing them anything to borrow. But if the yen starts to appreciate and interest rates start to rise over there, now those yen carry traders, those leveraged yen investments are going to start to get unwound. And those investments that those are in are going to get sold to go back and repay off those yen loans. That would be liquidity leaving those other markets, whether they're emerging markets or developed markets. It would be a path of draining liquidity from global speculative markets. And so that in itself has the potential to be destabilizing as well. And that's why I say this slide is super important, because I think regardless of what Japan decides to do, it has enormous implications for the rest of the world.
Now, going back to slide 10 for just a second, would it be fair to characterize your geopolitical view to say that what you expect is if there's geopolitical escalation, and what I mean by geopolitical escalation is things like, let's say, the conflict from Ukraine and Russia growing to the point where it doesn't feel so much like the U.S. providing financial aid to Ukraine, but the U.S. getting more directly involved with either more U.S. weapons or U.S. troops, U.S. boots on the ground, direct conflict between U.S. and Russia, potentially then escalating to China making a move on Taiwan, whether or not U.S. would be directly involved in a military conflict with China. You know, maybe it would start initially with some threats and some freedom of navigation exercises that get more and more harrowing and so forth. If those kinds of things were going on in the world, as I'm understanding you, you think that those would all be fundamental drivers for the dollar to continue to appreciate. And it would probably only be if you got to a point where the U.S. was suddenly clearly losing that war or conflict with China and Russia, that it would actually become negative for the U.S. dollar. Is that a fair overall approximation of your view?
That is a perfect way to say it. Yes. I think it, you know, someday down the road, you know, all global reserve currencies eventually come to an end and the new hegemon, you know, kind of, enforces its will on the rest of the world. But for that to happen, I think it would, you would either need to have economic chaos or military violence. And I think in either economic chaos or military violence, I think in that period of time, the US dollar appreciates.
Unfortunately, I agree with you. I think we have more economic chaos and military violence ahead of us. And I agree that it's likely to be dollar positive, at least initially. It would only be if we reach the point where the United States' military hegemony, not just the dollar's financial hegemony, was questioned. That would probably be the catalyst that would change everything for the dollar. Luke Groman would be proven right, and it would be a completely different world. Until then, I think we're in agreement that it's probably dollar bullish until that happens. Let's move on to page 14. Our listeners already know what fiat currency is. What's this point that you're making here?
Well, I think it's really important to point this out because I often speak to people and they say, well, if one fiat appreciates versus another, it only matters to currency traders. It doesn't matter to us on Main Street. And the point I want to get across is that is incorrect. Perhaps it doesn't matter if the Australian dollar rises versus the Kiwi dollar, or perhaps it doesn't matter if the euro rises versus the Hungarian florin or whatever it is. But if the US dollar is rising versus foreign fiat, it's a big deal. And the reason, again, goes back to the euro dollar market. Everything, you know, commodities around the world trade in dollars. Countries around the world have US dollar debt that they need to service. A lot of invoices are done in dollars. So as the dollar rises versus foreign currencies, it puts pressure on prices. And so, as the dollar tends to rise, prices tend to fall. And that's when bad things start to happen. And that's what I show on the next page, on page 15, is that a rising dollar versus other foreign currency, fiat, doesn't always lead to, but it always coincides with, crises around the world. Just go back over the last 25 years. Every time we've had a crisis around the world, it has coincided with dollar strength. Now, whether it's the dollar reacting to the crisis or whether the higher dollar causes the crisis, I think that's something that could probably be debated for a very long time. But the correlation is very clear. And that's why I say it's very, very easy to sit back and think that, oh, I don't need to worry about one fiat currency versus another because they all lose value over time. It would be nice if you had the ability to just ignore that. Unfortunately, I don't think that's the case. The dollar rising has huge implications for everybody around the world, even if it's only rising versus foreign currencies.
Hang on a minute, because I'm concerned about it rising against non-fiat currencies, specifically gold. Because if we were to just look at your chart on page 15, if you're expecting a move to new highs on the dollar index, this is not over yet, that in theory ought to be bearish gold. It's time to short gold. I got a strong feeling, Brent, that you're not shorting gold. So tell me how to think about gold when, frankly, what it's been trading as, at least in the last few years, is primarily an anti-dollar. It's mostly been trading inversely to the dollar index. Why wouldn't you be short gold if you see what you see?
Well, I think you could be on a tactical basis, but I just wouldn't recommend doing it if you're not extremely nimble. And let me explain what I mean by that. Is I think we are now at a point where it's not just one country that's in crisis and one country that's going to have to go back to QE or extreme monetary measures. And it's not just the US that will have to do it either. I think largely I don't want to use the word end game because I feel like everybody uses that and it's a little bit overplayed, but I think we are kind of at a point where everybody's starting to realize that these countries around the world, all of them have kind of gotten over their skis. They've kind of exhausted a lot of the different things that they can do as far as monetary policy or fiscal policy, and that as a result, fiat currencies are going to lose value versus real things as we enter another crisis and the governments have to quote unquote print their way out of it. And so I think what's likely to happen is we are going to get into a situation where all fiat, not just the US dollar, but all fiat is being debased versus real things. The dollar is rising versus foreign currencies, but gold is rising versus all of them. And that's how you get, if you're in the euro and you're looking up and you see the dollar and gold above you, that's the dollars and gold rising together versus all the other currencies. I don't know if we're there yet, Eric. And if we got into some type of a liquidating market like we saw in 2020 or 2018, I would expect gold to fall initially, but I wouldn't expect it to last very long. I would expect gold to recover very quickly and then be off to the races. I will say that gold over the last year, it's up, I don't know, 5-7% or something like that. But it's done that in the face of real rates rising. And in many ways, I think gold trades not necessarily inverse to the dollar, but mainly inverse to real rates. And gold has held up very well as real rates have risen. And to me, that's a positive sign. I'm not necessarily saying that gold can't go back down and, you know, retest some level. I know last year I was saying that it needed to hold the 1700 level, which it did, and it bounced and it stayed strong since then. But I would be very careful shorting gold. And the other thing I'd say is everybody should own gold as part of their portfolio. You know, I think everybody should have some kind of a strategic allocation of gold that doesn't get traded. Now, if in addition to that, you're pretty nimble and you want to do some, you know, short trades here and there or hedging trades, I think that's perfectly acceptable. But if you don't own any gold, I wouldn't be going out and shorting it right here.
Brent, I have to share some of your pessimism about the geopolitical outlook, but in terms of markets, is there anything that you're bullish on?
Well, you know, when your outlook like mine, it is sometimes hard to do that. But I will say the one area where I'm getting increasingly bullish on and where I've actually started to buy some stuff recently is in the commodity space, not in the industrial commodity space. And not in the hard commodities, but in the soft commodities, and specifically in corn and wheat and even coffee, I've been buying over the last couple of weeks. You know, in 2022, both corn and wheat had huge spikes higher. Part of it was geopolitically driven. Part of it was, I think, just a long term. You know, it had been a long time since it had a run like that. And for a little bit there, a year ago, I kind of felt like I had missed it. But then I kind of stepped back and I said, well, you know, I don't think that, you know, that direction and that speed with which both corn and wheat were rising was sustainable. So I kind of stepped back and said, I'm going to be patient. And what levels would I like to buy it at? Well, here this year, it's gotten back to those levels that I'd like to buy it at. So, you know, wheat had a huge breakout in 22 and then it had a huge retracement. It's kind of back down to a little bit below the $600 level where I've started buying it. And largely the same thing with corn, a huge run in 21, pullback, a huge run in 22, and then a pullback. And part of the reason that I'm starting to buy these is they're so beat up. The sentiment on them is so low. And at the end of the day, it's food and people have to eat. You know, you don't have to have an iPad, but you do have to eat. And, you know, and this also goes back to what we were talking about last year with the relatively mild winter. Crop yields were extremely good. Not only that, but Putin allowed for the grains from the Black Sea area and Ukraine to be exported. I'm not sure that he's going to be as generous this year, right? And then finally, that we're getting into an El Nino year, which is a weather, certain weather pattern that typically causes, again, it's nothing is guaranteed, but it typically causes problems with crop yields. And so when you put all those things, you have something that people have to have. It's beat up and the sentiment's out of whack. There's geopolitical concerns that could constrict the supply. And then you have weather patterns that could constrict supply even further. I feel like that's an area where, you know, I want to be exposed.
Brent, I can't thank you enough for a terrific interview. We didn't get to all of your slides. Listeners, I definitely encourage you to peruse the full slide deck. It's got some excellent stuff in there. Brent, before I let you go, please tell us more about what you do at Santiago Capital and particularly how people can follow your work.
Sure. Well, I have a wealth management firm. I've been doing this for close to 25 years now. I work with, you know, a handful of very high net worth individuals customizing wealth management plans for them. We do that through a combination of separately managed accounts and private funds. You know, I'm pretty active on social media. You know, I love to kind of debate with people on Twitter. And earlier this year, a friend of mine and I started a podcast called Milkshakes, Markets, and Madness, which is kind of a play on the whole dollar milkshake theory. And so we've had a lot of fun with that. And, you know, should anybody want to have a conversation or interact with me on one of those mediums, I'd be happy to do it.
And please tell our listeners where they can find the podcast and where to contact you.
You can find it at Milkshakes Pod on Twitter. You can find me at Santiago AU Fund. If you go to either one of those, you click the link, you can find our site. And then, you know, if people can send me an email at Brent@SantiagoCapital.com if they want to have kind of a one-on-one conversation.
Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, it was great to have Brent on the show. Now, let's get to that chart deck. Listeners, you're going to find the download link for the post-game chart deck in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, it means you have not yet registered at macrovoices.com. Just go to our homepage, macrovoices.com, and click on the red button over Brent's picture that says, looking for the downloads. Now, Eric, let's cover crude oil, starting with the EIA inventory data.
EIA printed a massive 10.6 million barrel drawdown that has erased all builds on inventory which had occurred year to date previously. Cushing, Oklahoma drawing down 1.5 million barrels, gasoline drawing down 214,000 barrels, distillates building 1.2 million barrels, U.S. production ticking up another 100,000 barrels to 12.8 million barrels. That's a new post-COVID high, and it also is an indication that we're seeing a sustained move above the previous plateau around 12.3, 12.4 million barrels, where we were stuck for probably 7 or 8 months. I bought the dip, but only nibbled on this. I was waiting for a retest of $77 WTI in order to really lever up on my long position. Maybe I missed the bottom already. We'll see. I don't think the really big upside comes until next year anyway, so I'm not rushing too much here to chase this market. If we do get that dip to 77, I'll be adding to my longs at that point.
Eric, when looking on page 2 at that crude oil futures chart, I have that 50-day and the 200-day simple moving average on there. And when oil broke out and got back up towards its first quarter highs, we obviously had the price action pause, and it retraced back toward that 50-day moving average. But overall, the price action has been relatively good and accumulative. What I want to look back is to the end of 2020 and the start of 2021. After that bloodbath in oil, you saw the crude oil prices consolidate back above these moving averages, and it became the beginning of a 1.5 year bull run in oil. Now, it is incredibly premature for us to already assume something like that is happening, but we've now spent over a year consolidating and backfilling and correcting in oil and spending a lot of time below those moving averages. And this is the first time after that deep correction that we're seeing oil doing some constructive price action. If we see all of that resistance level that was established at the top end here in this $80 to $82, $83 area beaten in the coming weeks, it may be a sign that some bull continuation pattern is getting underway.
Patrick, with Nick off this week, I want to turn our post-game segment upside down and interview you on some option strategy questions that I've been mulling for the sake of my own trading. Specifically, I remember reading about the cheapest left-tail hedges of all time on ZeroHedge about a month ago. I've been kicking myself ever since for not taking advantage of sale prices on left-tail hedges back at that time. Now that we're seeing the market push back up toward its prior highs, I want to start with my first question, which is, do you still think, as you alluded last week, that we're in some sort of topping process on equities?
Eric, yeah, I still will stand by my view that we're in some sort of a topping process. When looking at that chart on page 3, I've highlighted the previous corrections that were often in this kind of 2 to 400 point, 5% variety of corrections. And this pullback that we just had looks like a cookie cutter of all of these in the past. And generally, with this type of a bull reversal that we've seen over the last few trading sessions, it leaves the window open for retesting highs or even potentially breaking slightly to a higher high. And I think a reference point that I think is a really interesting way of comparing this is if we look on page 4 to the S&P 500 chart through the period of 2005 to 2007. So obviously, when looking rearview mirror, we know that that was the period right before the great financial crisis. We knew that Greenspan and Bernanke raised interest interest rates into the middle of 2006, over 4%. And we started to see cracks in things like subprime in early 2007. But you can observe that in spite of a lot of these warning signs, the market would have these corrections and then proceed to make higher highs. Even in the summer of 2007, when there were a number of these Bear Stearns subprime credit hedge funds that were blowing up and needed to be bailed out, the market still turned around and managed to make a higher high in October of 2007 before the bear market began. And so I really just want to step back and reflect on, well, just because we know that the Fed is slowing this economy and that it could lead to a recession and that inevitably something breaks in that, it doesn't mean that the market can't stay up here longer than people can expect. And while I do think that there's a high vulnerability to inevitably a deep market correction to inevitably turn its head, you know, maybe Darius Dale will be right with, you know, the recession coming in fourth quarter, first quarter of the upcoming year. Maybe we'll start seeing the market start to care at some point. But at this stage, I think a topping formation where the market fakes out bears and then fakes out bulls and creates maximum confusion up here is still the path of least resistance and likely to happen.
Now tell me about the value proposition of options-based left-tail hedging strategies in terms of how the premia for those strategies compares with historical norms for the cost of similar hedges.
Yeah, well, a month ago, we were doing that special webinar for Macro Voice listeners where I was talking about buying insurance, which was incredibly cheap in the markets from a put perspective. And I was explaining why during the webinar. I know a whole series of our listeners took advantage of that. So congratulations to them. Now, I wanted to, though, kind of create the backdrop of understanding where we are on this. So I wanted to, on page 5, talk about where we are on volatility premium. And so here I took, it's not the 30-day VIX that most people are used to looking at, but I wanted to look at a one-year volatility index because when tail risk hedging, you often want to go with a little more duration rather than, you know, rolling hedges every single 30 days. And so what you can observe here is that we are at multi-year lows, even after this correction over the last month. On one-year volatility, we obviously are not back to 2019 lows, but I'm not even certain we will get that low in any sequence, even if the market does rally back to its highs. And so we are, at least on a volatility premium basis, on the low ends of the spectrum of cost. The other thing I have a chart on page 6 is the CBOE volatility skew or the skew index. And we are trading at the upper boundaries of the typical range of the skew. And this means that option left tail skew does exist. And so while buying insurance on the markets is cheap on an implied basis, it does steepen and it is more costly when you're going and buying left tail insurance. As you're going 10 or 20% below the market, it is got steepness to it, but there are option strategies you can use to overcome that. And so we can talk about some of the different things in terms of the ways that one can hedge. But the last point that I wanted to make before we move on is what is driving an additional kicker that causes a lot of this insurance to be cheaper than before, and that is essentially interest rates. One of the discounting mechanisms in options pricing is interest rates, and the sensitivity of an option to interest rates is option Greek known as rho. And what we have is a period where we are at these 5%+ interest rates that have to be discounted into these options. Particularly, the longer dated options are more sensitive to this as they are discounting more and more interest rate in it. And so the fact that we have the interest rate environment we are in, that generally is making call options more expensive and put options cheaper. Now, that is inherently a function of option pricing, but that's certainly for someone who thinks that the market here is vulnerable and wants to buy downside hedges, it makes it that much more attractive to be buying some of these puts to buy some of that downside protection.
Okay, now I want to expand the conversation and explain why I'm so concerned with hedging broad market risk in the stock market, considering that most of my trading focuses on commodity futures, which are a completely different asset class. The reason is that I'm extremely bullish on uranium miners over the next 5 to 10 years, and I want to establish a very significant position in that space. But look, similar to junior gold mining shares, uranium miners and uranium mining juniors in particular are famously overowned by retail investors, meaning that a crash or sudden correction in broader markets could easily bring on a margin call that wipes out over-leveraged retails. So I'm not about to lever up my holdings in junior mining shares unless I have a solid hedge in place to cover the scenario where, despite the fundamentals remaining strong, the uranium mining sector takes a nosedive for all the same reasons that junior gold miners have been clobbered in past broad market sell-offs. Now, to be clear, the reason I'm asking about cheap left-tail hedges on the S&P is because there's so much liquidity in those broader markets, and because rumor has it that hedge premia have recently traded at historically unprecedented discounts. I also think that your answers on that topic are going to appeal to far more of our Macro Voices listeners, and that's the real reason that I asked that question first. So let's start off with how attractive or unattractive broad market hedges are at the moment and what the best vehicles are to put them on with. Please answer that first, and then we'll come back to whether a more direct hedge on uranium mining would make more sense given my trading needs.
So, Eric, I think that it is relatively attractive still, but because of the skew, it generally is, in my opinion, more favorable to be expressing downside hedges through spreads that are removing very specific parts of the downside risk. So let's just build a few scenarios to give an example. So let's say you are bearish in the second half of this year, and you want for the remainder of this year to build some sort of a hedge that kicks in on the left tail once the market is down greater than 5% from the current level. And what you want to do is remove the downside risk, or at least create a hedge that is going to give you protection for a 20% decline in the markets this year. And so you're basically having that hedge kick in 5% below the market and hedging 20% for the remainder of this year. Something like that costs you under a half of a percent in terms of the notional value of what you're trying to hedge. Now, at the same time, let's say you were even more bearish and you believe, let's say, that the risk is over the next 1 year. And so you're taking an S&P hedge that you want the left tail insurance to kick in if the market drops greater than 5% from where the current levels are, where S&P is right now around 4,500 at the time of recording. And you wanted 25% downside protection. So that it's protecting a 25% market correction on the downside. This type of a hedge is going to cost you over 2% of the notional value of that you're trying to hedge. And so so there are choices for you out there. I think that that's a reasonable cost for somebody who is fully invested and or even leveraged on the upside of the market and wants to have some degree of protection to ensure that if the markets did start getting ugly, you had a way of protecting yourself on that downside. But also I wanted to highlight just a very basic strategy, which it may not apply to someone trying to hedge a uranium portfolio. But one of the things, because of that interest rate factor that we talked about in terms of interest rates causing calls to be generally more expensive and puts to be generally cheaper, this actually allows the caller strategy to be more attractive than it was in the past. As an example, if for the rest of the year you wanted to create a hedge wrap where you said, I want the upside of the market all the way up towards 5,000 on an existing position in the S&P, and yet I want the hedge to kick in on all downside risk below 4,000. If for the rest of this year, you're talking about outlaying a debit of just under 20 S&P points to be able to put on that trade. Now, what's interesting is that if you go farther out and construct that same collar, because interest rates become a bigger factor on longer dated options, you actually can create a 5,000 upper boundary and a 4,000 lower boundary on a collar on the S&P 500 going out 1 year to August of next year and actually receive a 25 S&P point credit. You're actually paid to have this type of a hedge on. Now, of course, if the stock market goes ripping north of 5,000, then you're forfeiting a certain amount of returns. But if in any way you feel that the stock market has only limited upside, these become very reasonable ways to put on some protection.
Okay, now let's come back to my actual trading situation. I'm proud to say that I did a great job of timing the April-May low in mining shares. That, plus my trusted copy of Uranium Insider, which is our friend Justin Hune's newsletter, allowed me to establish my first tranche of uranium mining shares right on those spring bottoms. But fearing broader market weakness in coming months, I only started with 10% of my intended final allocation in this first tranche. Those shares are now up 40% in the last few months, which is great, but that also means they could very easily go down more than 40% if we get a bear market resumption, as so many of our macro guests have predicted. I'm convinced that we're still in the very early innings of this uranium bull market and that we're headed toward much higher numbers. So I don't mind adding to my longs, even up here after 40% of upside that I've just seen off of those April-May lows in some of the stocks I bought at that time, but not without some kind of efficiently priced hedge. So please help me design one.
Well, Eric, the idea of adding an S&P 500 hedge on a basket of uranium stocks is assuming a liquidity event. Because even if we had a 20% market correction, if it was more systematic, it might just involve sector rotation and, you know, the Magnificent Seven having a sell-off. And it may not stem into a liquidity event where the correlation of all assets go to one and everything is dropping as the market is just nosediving. So really, if you're overlaying S&P 500 hedges to a uranium basket, stock basket, then you're really only hedging that liquidity event, which is that something, you know, shit hits the fan and things really get out of hand, and this is going to help blunt the downside. One of the things you could do is simply consider hedging using the uranium ETF, the Global X Uranium ETF, which is the symbol URA. Now, you can go out there, and let's just say you said that what I want to hedge is the downside risk of uranium correcting more than 10%, and I wanted to hedge out up to a 30% decline in uranium stocks during an event like this. And so again, using a spread trade that would kick in 10% below where the current uranium market is and hedge out a 30% decline in uranium, you're talking about a $1 outlay on the ETF, which equates to just over 4% in total cost. Now, 4% is a little more expensive than the numbers we were talking about on the S&P, but the correlation will be much stronger as your real uranium mining stocks will genuinely be going down in a period where the URA hedge is building intrinsic value. And when you're looking at a scenario where, you know, on the upside of these uranium plays, you're probably talking, you know, three-digit returns on the upside when this thing goes ripping, you know, paying 4% to have a tail risk insurance that allows you to hold through a downside correction may be a reasonable way to put on this hedge when you have such distinct concentration in just one sector. Nonetheless, Eric, let's move on to page 7 where we have that US dollar index. What are you thinking here?
Needless to say, Brent's perspective is sobering. I don't feel qualified to really have an opinion one way or the other on whether the Dixie could move to new higher highs above 115. But I will go on record as saying authoritatively, right here, right now, if that happens, it's going to break a lot of other things, starting with EM debt. Coming back to the near term, the test of 104 that we just saw was super important. So far, it's rejecting back lower, but that was only the first attempt at taking out the very important technical level of 104. Whether the downside rejection continues or if we see a successful breakout above 104 is going to be the big tell that tells us where the next leg is going to go. So far, it's pointing towards staying in the consolidation range rather than breaking out higher, but it's still too early to call it either way.
Yeah, well, for me on this chart, we just continue to find overhead resistance in this 104 to 105 level. And until we see a genuine kind of a driver that creates a risk off in the broader markets, then in my mind, we are in a situation that genuinely can have the US dollar just stay in this trade range on the short term, but it will probably inevitably be a big signal when we have a bull breakout above this resistance that's been establishing itself all year long. So let's see how deep this correction goes and where the bulls can dig in. All right, Eric, let's move on to uranium. On page 8, I have that Sprott Physical Uranium Trust. What are you thinking here on uranium?
To understand it requires first understanding the legal structure and the mechanism of operation of the Sprott Physical Uranium Trust, known as SPUT, which is the most common vehicle for holding uranium. Because they buy physical metal, their buying can actually be a big factor in the market. But the rules of the game say that SPUT never buys physical uranium when it's trading at a discount to NAV, as it has been for several months. So SPUT has not been an active buyer in this market. That means all the guys who bid up SPUT shares in the last few weeks bought their interest in the trust's existing uranium holdings from other guys who already own SPUT shares that they were willing to part with. But if continued speculation on the long side of SPUT drives its price to a premium over its net asset value, that will allow the managers of SPUT to begin buying more physical uranium on the physical market in order to add to the trust's coffers. This transition from below NAV to above NAV trading on SPUT has happened before, and the uranium bugs are all getting excited that it's about to happen again. So that means that there could already be some speculative interest wound up on the long side of the market already. Of course, anything's possible, but there may be a setup for an acceleration of the bull trend if SPUT breaks out to trade at a meaningful premium over NAV. More buying of SPUT forces more buying of physical uranium by SPUT, which drives the market price up, in turn driving more speculative interest into the long side of SPUT, and it all turns into a self-reinforcing virtuous cycle.
Yeah, Eric, it's very bullish that Sprott Physical is getting back up to its previous highs, but that uranium U308 spot price is still a little away from that $64 high from 2022. But I remain relatively bullish here. But what is interesting is when you look on page 9 and see Cameco, which is one of the largest uranium plays that is available on the markets, it is a very clean and bullish breakout. And at this stage, obviously, there will be short-term corrections along the way. But it really does look like this uranium story is working very well. All right, let's talk some gold.
Well, we're up $70 off the lows, so the fact that we have a new bullish impulse that's hit the market cannot be questioned. What we can debate is what the fundamental catalyst was to launch this move. The world moved a step closer to nuclear war last week, so it could be argued that the security concerns in the wake of Prigozhin's killing are driving the strength in gold. But frankly, if there's anything we've seen since the beginning of the Ukraine conflict, it's that gold has, for the most part, ignored geopolitical risks and is traded mostly as an inverse dollar proxy. As of Wednesday afternoon, we're trading right on the 100-day moving average at 1972, and a break above that level could be argued from a technical analysis perspective to mark the end of the correction.
Yeah, generally, just the way Brunt alluded to it, it was that it's pretty bullish the way gold has generally held up. I mean, if you really look at the rates markets and you look at the dollar strength, one would think that gold could have been much more vulnerable on the downside. And yet the corrections, while we certainly had some, didn't no major technical damage. Just as an example, I have that 200-day moving average on there and we're corrected to it, but it certainly hasn't done any violations of the trend. And this is where I think we can generally maintain a bit of a bullish bias on that. But what I wanted to just leave with here, Eric, was just touch on that 10-year U.S. Treasury note futures on page 11. And we had a direct retest. I put this on a weekly chart so you can really see that huge bond bear market we had in 2021 into 2022. And really, we retested this low. And I kind of step back and ask on a macro scale, when we have the Fed having done what it's done, inflation already well off of its highest levels, and a lot of initial readings on things like PMIs already showing economic contraction, is this an environment where we can have long-term yields make considerable moves higher? And under my opinion, I think there's a reasonable chance that these lows will hold. Now, that doesn't make me super bullish bonds, but I don't necessarily think that the risk of a big breakdown is as high as a lot of the pundits out on the Twitterverse are suggesting. It'll be interesting to see in the coming weeks whether or not we make it back to that 50-day moving average, and that this becomes far more of a basing formation than a major downtrend.
Folks, if you enjoy Patrick's chart decks, you can get them every single day of the week with a free trial of Big Picture Trading. The details are on the last pages of the slide deck, or just go to bigpicturetrading.com. Patrick, tell them what they can expect to find in this week's Research Roundup.
This week, you're going to find the transcript for today's interview, as well as Brent's slide deck and the chart book we just discussed here in the postgame, and a number of links to articles that we found interesting. So you're going to find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup. That does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com, and we will consider it for our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at MacroVoices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend. That's Eric spelled with a K. And you can follow me at Patrick Serezna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week, free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.